Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. And let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:04 a.m. on Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. And present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Carpenter, Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Merrick. Representative Rasmussen is online. Representative Rasmussen, are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we've also got Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, and Representative Johnson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. And today's presentations, they are a completion of the OMB's overview of the governor's FY22 budget and the governor's 10-year plan, as well as amendments. And then we'll get an overview of the FY22 budget by the Legislative Finance Director, Alexi Painter. And we've got 2 hours set aside for this meeting, so we'll give each presenter an hour. Yesterday, we didn't get to the second presentation until the end of the 2 hours that we had allotted. So I want to make sure to give all of our presenters adequate time. With that, once we get to the end of the first presentation, if we could hold questions till the end of each presentation and then give each presenter about an hour. So with that, first up, we've got OMB's presentation with Neil Steininger, Director of OMB. And with that, if you could put yourself on the record, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director, Office of Management and Budget. And to start, I actually want to answer a question that was asked yesterday that, and actually was asked the week prior that I wasn't able to answer. The Palmer Correctional Center schedule for reopening. DOT is scheduled to complete their work in July of this year, with Department of Corrections taking over the facility the following months in August. So I just wanted to get that on the record since I was able to get an answer this yesterday afternoon. So we finished up with law yesterday, so I'll start here with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. You can see here a increase in fiscal year 21 in the general fund line, and the comparison between 19 and 22, there's a fairly significant increase in unrestricted general funds in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Really, the reason for this isn't an actual state budget increment, but it's reflecting the transfer of the SATS and ALMAR programs into the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs from the Department of Administration. That's the State of Alaska Telecommunications System and Alaska Land Mobile Radio programs. In moving those over to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, as they've been looking at the management of those programs, you know, kind of bringing them under new management, looking at the services delivered, they're looking to combine those two sort of under one name, the Alaska Public Safety Communications Services, which they believe really better aligns the name with the services and the beneficiaries of those services, because the primary users of these systems really are Alaska's public safety, both the Department of Public Safety troopers as well as other state police departments and other emergency responders. The department has also eliminated a couple of vacant positions, including a budget analyst, a deputy director, a communications engineer, and a maintenance journeyman. There's savings of about $280,000 in unrestricted general funds, as well as a reduction in federal receipts that were associated with those positions. They've also made some reductions just based on looking at trends of prior year spending, on particularly on maintenance costs within the department, and finding other ways to achieve those goals and kind of aligning that budget to what they've historically spent. So moving to the Department of Natural Resources. You can see a pretty steady decline in the budgets for the Department of Natural Resources since the peak in 2015. Over the last 3 years, they've seen a reduction of 17.4%, a little over $10 million in unrestricted general funds. A lot of this, one thing to to note on the Department of Natural Resources, prior slides, we'd shown the numbers net of supplemental requests to give kind of a true picture of the size of those department budgets. Department of Natural Resources is a little bit different in that fire suppression costs are included in their agency budget. And for those who have been following this department for a while, probably know that fire suppression costs are wildly variable. So we've removed those from these numbers so they don't reflect things like the $110 million spent on fire suppression 2 years ago. But related to fire suppression and related to that activity, this year we're seeing a very low amount of fires, a very low fire suppression year in terms of the amount that they're having to spend. So they believe that they'll have some excess money at the end of the year in that normal cost, that normal baseline cost for fire suppression. They'd like to utilize some of that excess funding in order to support fuel mitigation and to cut fire breaks. So really the idea being, you know, money that we had budgeted for putting out wildfires, use it for prevention purposes in the following year if we don't need to spend it. And ideally over time that will reduce the need for fire suppression activity. They've also added $250,000 in support of park ranger law enforcement. They found that there just wasn't adequate budget to provide for the necessary equipment for those park rangers. And so this increment's necessary just to support the activities that they perform and ensure that they have, you know, current and up-to-date equipment. In the Division of Oil and Gas, as well as the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, we've found that they've collected receipts that are, you know, greater than the amount they've been spending over the last several years, and it appears that trend will continue into the future. So we're able to offset some unrestricted general fund costs by utilizing those receipts. The amount that we're projecting that should be sustainable over the long term based on the trends we've been seeing over the last several years is a little over $2.5 million in offset of general fund costs. There's also an adjustment to a increment from last year. There's an increment in the fiscal year 21 budget for plan review, but as they've been implementing that increment, they found that they had overestimated the cost that they need. So they're able to reduce that prior year addition by $100,000. In the Department of Public Safety, you can see that this is one of the departments that has had an increasing budget over the last several years as we've made strategic investments in public protection related fields. Increases in troopers have been a priority area within budgets over the last several years. This year, we're not adding any new troopers. However, we are fully funding troopers added in the prior year. So in fiscal year 21, several new troopers were added, a quite large number of new troopers were added, but they were added at 75% funding, just in acknowledgement of the department's leg in recruitment. We knew at that time that the department wouldn't be able to recruit all of the troopers day one in the fiscal year, so they didn't need the full funding. This increment brings them to that full funding level so they can support those trooper salaries year round. There's a handful of very small, but they add up to quite a bit, adjustments in the department's budget in non-law enforcement related areas. So this is more the back of house and support services areas where they found either positions that that have been vacant for quite some time, or they found areas where they can reduce travel budgets or commodity spending or other contractual savings. This is spread out through probably 6 or 7 budget components, but adds up to almost $1 million, a little over $900,000 in unrestricted general funds. They're also eliminating 2 vacant building plan review positions that were added in a recent year that just haven't been filled, and they're looking at ways that they can satisfy that activity through other means, be it public-private partnership or other staff in the department.
I got a question from Representative LeBon, and were you finished with this section?
Yes.
Okay. Representative LeBon in the Northeast.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is regarding vacant building plan review positions. I had this subcommittee budget the last 2 years, and one of the concerns I heard was the delays in building plan approvals around the state through the fire marshal's office. You mentioned that there's an effort to outsource these building plan reviews and approvals. Are you aware if the response of building plan approvals has gotten better? I mean, I heard 6 months delays to getting building plans through the marshal's office approved. Are you aware of that situation, and can you update me on the status?
Through the chair, Representative Lebon, I am aware of the general situation, the general concern of building plan review timeliness. I don't have any statistics to update you with, but we'll get with the department and provide you some information on that.
And I thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an unfair question for me to ask you that, and I will ask the Department of Public Safety when they present to the subcommittee. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps I need to postpone my question as well. Do we have anybody from Public Safety online and available right now?
No, we don't.
Okay. Mr. Steininger, you wouldn't happen to know within these numbers here whether they reflect the plan to consolidate trooper dispatch. Are the numbers in order to make that happen, the dollars in order to make that happen within this particular budget, or do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I don't believe that's reflected here in these numbers. I think we can get a response from the department with more specifics on kind of that sort of evolving and moving issue.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
So in the Department of Revenue, you can see one interesting piece when you look at this graph. You can see most of it is the light gray other funds. It's the overwhelming majority of spending in the Department of Revenue. Really, that reflects management of state assets, both in the Treasury as well as the Permanent Fund Corporation. So generally speaking, management of those assets comes from the funds being managed, and that is reflected as an other fund source. So in terms of significant budget changes, you'll see most of those budget changes land in the other funds as well. While they're not a direct impact to state unrestricted general fund per se, they do have an impact to the state finances in terms of reducing costs and managing some of those funds, which reaps benefits in the use of those funds at a later date. So a $10 million reduction to the Retirement Management Board investment management costs, while it doesn't show an unrestricted general fund savings on the state's budget, over time, that reduces costs of managing the retirement system, which reduces the need for deposits into the retirement system over time. We're also looking at restructuring some of the ways that we pay for other investment management for smaller funds. So a lot of those funds management has been paid with unrestricted general fund. We're proposing to kind of move that policy of charging the fund, which is being managed, for the cost of managing the fund. So you'll see there's a $1.4 million reduction in general fund costs, with additions of that cost pointing to those funds being managed. In the child support division, their current case management system is a very antiquated system on the state's mainframe system. They're looking to move it to a web-based platform, which will reduce the cost of system support and reduce the cost of maintaining that mainframe system. It also provides them a measure as they work towards a more robust modern system that would tie in with other IT systems used by the Department of Revenue. So there is a reduction in general fund cost there. There's a corresponding request in the capital budget related to creating and building out that new system. There's also a move to, also three vacant positions within the department that have been vacant for quite some time. And they're able to eliminate those positions without any real impact to the workload. In the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, we have a proposal to implement incentive compensation for the fund managers. The $890,000 listed is the maximum amount that they think would be needed to do that. That may not be the actual amount paid out in incentive compensation.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just have to make comment about the incentive compensation plan. Tried to put that in the budget last year, and it was cut. So I'm happy to see that it's in the budget this year. The payment of a performance bonus, if you will, is standard in the industry. So the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees has been recommending this, I believe, for quite some time. So just a final comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is this is only paid for above average performance. This is paid for exceeding expectations. And you could argue that exceeding those expectations creates a cash flow to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation that will self-fund this compensation plan, this incentive compensation plan. So that's more a comment and less a question, but thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What he said.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, the how much is being asked for in the capital budget relative to the Child Support Division case management system?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe it's $12 or $15 million for the total project cost. I could be slightly off on that number. The cost of that system, there's federal share as part of that, so it's not entirely state-borne cost. They're also, they receive certain garnishments for child support that will help fund that as well on the state side that are by federal law due to the child support agency and not to individuals. Which the Department of Revenue can give a much better explanation of the mechanics there. So the actual general fund cost to the new system is relatively low compared to that overall dollar value. And in the long run will help achieve some budget savings in terms of the actual management of the system and bringing it, you know, one of the key components on that project is bringing it into the same system that they're using currently in other areas in Department of Revenue. So they have kind of one unified system for the department.
Okay. Just a comment. Hello? When I see our foregoing $864,000 in federal revenue, you know, I look at that and then I look at the capital investment and say, okay, where's the net benefit here? But I think you've given me some understanding of both the efficiency and the need to achieve this in the out years. Okay, thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. We had revenue present to us in the subcommittee yesterday, and one of the pages they had listed the returns on investment on the ARM board and compared it to the permanent fund, and they have a little competition in-house, and the five-year average return, the ARM board slightly outperformed the permanent fund. They were pretty proud of that. But the other category was the PCE fund, which, granted, is only $1 billion, but it outperformed both of them on the five-year average, and they have passive management, zero management, no bonuses, no fees. They just put it in a certain fund and let it ride, and it outperformed both the permanent fund and the ARM board over the five-year average. So, food for thought.
Mr. Steininger.
Thank you. So moving to Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, one of the big changes here in this year is a transfer from Department Administration of the remaining facilities management activities. So now in the fiscal year 22 budget and going forward, we'll have, you know, all management of all state facilities as well as leasing exist within the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And, you know, that level of workload necessitates formally creating a new division within the department. And so you can see in the budget structure now the Division of Facility Services called out distinctly. It used to be sort of spread throughout the maintenance and operations section in Department of Transportation. And so having all of those activities under one roof really will allow the state to give a better holistic look at space utilization and space management, whether it's owned or leased space. Another big change that we've made in the Department of Transportation in the fiscal year 22 budget is utilizing CARES Act funding to displace unrestricted general fund. This CARES Act funding is related to the Federal Aviation Administration funding that we discussed in our presentation yesterday. About $14.6 million of that funding is available to offset general fund costs in fiscal year 22. And allow for the department to maintain those activities. This, however, it's very important to note, is a short-term solution. So next year, you will be seeing us come back with some discussion of how to backfill these revenues when they're no longer there. But the situation the state is in right now in terms of cash available, it's necessary to utilize the tools that we have. The Alaska Marine Highway System has been put forward as a budget that is sort of a baseline budget from what was proposed last fiscal year. This represents a reduction of about $3.6 million in unrestricted general fund. The department is still undergoing investigation based on the reshaping study that was done over this summer. Looking at that, working with stakeholders, including legislative stakeholders, as well as members of communities, to get a better idea of what the future of that system is and how to provide the best service to Southeast Alaska. So this budget item really is looking at bringing it to a baseline for those conversations to discuss what the future of that system is. The department has been impacted over the last several years by shortfalls in motor fuel tax. There have been a couple other budget actions over prior years related to this. This year, there's a shift of about $500,000 that is effectively unrealizable motor fuel tax authority within the department's budget, and shifting that to unrestricted general fund so those maintenance activities can continue. We also, in talking with the Department of Transportation, found that they were doing maintenance on roads that were not state-owned but also did not have any agreement in place in terms of the state agreeing to perform those maintenance activities, and so we're proposing to cease those maintenance activities until there's an agreement in place.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the motor fuel tax shortfall that we've been experiencing, is there any reports on how much of this shortfall is due to electric cars that are getting very prevalent now? And if that's where the shortfall is partly brought to, is there anything in the mill to charge them some kind of a road fee because they're driving on the roads without paying motor fuel tax, which takes care of the roads?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I don't know how much of the change in collections here is a result of more fuel efficient vehicles and electric vehicles. I think either Department of Revenue or Department of Transportation could probably explain that a lot better than me. And I'm not sure if there's any legislation being worked on or being thought of to address that issue. I think I'd defer that question to others.
Okay, I've got Representative Josephson, then Merrick, then Wool. Representative Josephson.
Just on the last point, I have House Bill 104, which would mirrors Senator Bishop's bill from last term. Through the chair, Mr. Steininger, just very basically here, the $14.6 million reduction in GF, in the absence of COVID, which would be nice, the FY 19 to 22 change would look more like about $30 million?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that's correct.
A follow-up?
Follow-up?
I'm I'm sure, Mr. Chairman, that Representative Ortiz will want to ask about this as well, but I'm confused by the use of the term the funding of essential service levels for the marine highway system. The media accounts and the scuttlebutt and anecdotally is that essential services level isn't met now. So why would it be met with less if you have an answer?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yeah, I think a more robust answer of kind of the intricacies of how the system works and how they provide what they consider to be essential service might be good to discuss with Department of Transportation, and we can certainly help, you know, facilitate that and get a better written response to you. There's a lot of, you know, complexity to providing the service through Alaska Marine Highways, whether it's, you know, aging vessels that can't be brought online due to breakdowns, which we saw a couple of years ago, which impacted service delivery, or, you know, this year they're pretty significantly impacted by COVID in the way that they're able to operate the vessels, just given that the vessels by nature are a congregate setting. So there are a lot of different factors that have been impacting existing service and the way they think about, and the philosophy with which they approach the schedule is something that's been looked at through the reshaping study as well. So how they define, you know, or how they meet the different needs of the different communities and how they arrange that schedule to meet that need, that, you know, will increase, hopefully increase ridership, which also drives these costs quite a bit. When you see, you know, very low ridership, they collect very little money, but is that, you know, is that a result of schedule, or is that a result of availability of boats, or is that a result of some combination? It's difficult to say. It is a very complicated issue. What we're looking at here to do is, you know, to really, you know, focus on a schedule that meets the basic needs in the state with as little, you know, excess activity as possible, effectively.
It's just interesting to note, Mr. Chairman, that and certainly the governor and the legislature can have a different view of this, but the legislature for the last several years has had the opposite position and has been supplementing at every opportunity. So it's just hard to get to the truth of the matter. Thank you.
I think our subcommittee will be looking pretty closely at this one. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Steiniger. Can you tell me the elimination of maintenance of non-state-owned roads? Can you tell me where those roads are located?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe it is in the budget documents accompanying the change records, but we'll provide that to you in writing.
Thanks.
Yeah. Representative Wool and then Merrick. I mean, Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to Mr. Representative Thompson's question, I think electric vehicles compromise a minuscule percentage of cars in Alaska. And if I'm not mistaken, that the total motor fuel tax is approximately $40 million annually. So half a million is 1/80th. So it's 1.5% thereabout. So I think the increase in mileage that cars get is probably attributable to most of that. My question is the $50 million in other increase, and maybe you mentioned it and I didn't catch it, where does that come from and where does that go?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, thank you for the question. That really is the transfer of those facilities activities. So the Public Building Fund, which manages all of the state's, or most of the state's office buildings, was transferred into Department of Transportation, and the funding is listed as other. It's, you know, basically lease payments from state agencies that pay into the maintenance of those buildings and show up in the budget as a duplicated other fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So transportation and public facilities is getting bigger because now it's incorporating all public facilities, not just the one. It's moving some over that were in other agencies. With this department getting bigger, could one anticipate a bifurcation similar to Hess, where it would be one would just do transportation, road maintenance, and all that, and the other one would just do buildings. And since some would think the two are kind of different, is this agency getting bigger? Does that mean why we should split it into two like they're doing with Hess?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, what we've done here in the budget and from management perspective is to spin facilities maintenance activities in Department of Transportation off into a separate division within the department. So that really is the way that we're trying to handle that increase in responsibility, is kind of elevating it to a division level. Previously, those activities were sort of baked into the regional budgets, but that was when DOT was also managing primarily its own facilities. So now that they're managing facilities on behalf of others as well, it makes more sense to be in a separate division. I don't know that that activity is large enough to be its own department, though. It's really just maintenance of facilities, management of space, may not require cabinet level oversight in that sense.
Yeah. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow a little bit up on Representative Josephson's line of questioning around the Alaska Marine Highway System. First of all, just a comment, Mr. Steiniger, I'm sure there was no, you just commented that the Marine Highway System serves Southeast Alaska, and in fact, it serves all of coastal Alaska, not just Southeast Alaska. It's a pretty extensive system, and expensive, for sure. You mentioned the recommendations coming forward from the committee that was appointed by the governor. Can you tell me about any specific recommendations that went forward that are now in the process of being enacted by the department based on those recommendations?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think I would defer that question to the department, but we can get a written response to you. One thing to note, this budget proposal that was put forward in December was pretty shortly after that reshaping study. So the ability to actually implement many changes from the reshaping study in time for inclusion in the December budget really wasn't, there wasn't enough time for them to be implemented. So when I refer to this as more of a baseline starting point for those discussions, really that's why that information was fairly fresh at the time that we had put this together. So we do look forward to having those discussions and figuring out how the system looks going forward. But I can get you a response of what's been implemented to date from the reshaping study and how they've changed their management philosophy as a result.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter and then Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious real quick if the PCN changes, both the permanent and, full-time and non-permanent, are related to the new division of facilities.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes. So the Public Building Fund had a handful of staff that managed the fund itself and managed the facilities that moved over from department administration. So primarily these changes are transfers from department administration. So to the comment of the $50 million increase in other funds, really that's a $50 million decrease in other departments as well. So the total pie is not growing, just DOT's slice, if you will.
Follow up. I'm just not perfectly clear. There's no decrement of PCNs in the administration budget on slide 10. And if the organization's being moved from administration, shouldn't there be a negative number or a reduction over here?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, it's the positive number in department administration is net of the negative of the amount going to transportation. They're also, kind of confounding this is that they're also consolidating all of procurement activity. So they have a lot of positions coming from other agencies into DOA. So it's the numbers get a little bit messy.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I have a question also going back to eliminate maintenance on non-state-owned roads, and this is probably a question for the department, but maybe you can and bring back some information. So is it all state-owned roads, or is it just some of them? So if it's only, if it's all of them, that's one thing, but if it's a, if it's some of the state-owned roads, then I guess I'm curious what process was used to see which ones were selected. And then the next piece to that would be, when would that transfer of maintenance take place? Some municipal government, they need a little bit of time, heads up wise, because this could be a significant impact in their budget to plan for road maintenance in the future. So I would like to know more about that.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the intention here was to capture, you know, any areas where a non-state owned road was being maintained by DOT without an agreement to do so. I believe, you know, or at the time when we put this forward in December, we believed that to be a, you know, comprehensive list. I believe there might be a road or two that weren't, that the understanding of which roads didn't have an agreement at the time we put together in December, you know, wasn't complete. So there may be some other roads that should be included in this list and should be identified. Really, this is to identify those areas where, you know, the state's picking up a responsibility for which there's no, where the state doesn't have a clear responsibility to perform that activity. So really, the lack of that agreement, or the, you know, lack of that direct responsibility to the state, is what we're trying to identify.
Alwood?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, what kind of timeline are you looking at for?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, timeline here, this decrement would take place, would be effective on July 1st of this calendar year, so the first day of the fiscal year. So, you know, maintenance would continue through this, you know, through this winter, and wouldn't be, we wouldn't be cutting it off midwinter, but it would be, you know, this middle of this summer that that responsibility would shift.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Steininger?
So the University of Alaska is on slide 27. You can see in the table at the top between 19 and 22 the impacts of the compact between the executive branch and the university to phase in reductions to the university system over time. Fiscal year 22 is the final year of that compact with a $20 million reduction. In addition, the university is looking to transition the UA Foundation to a nonprofit structure. So this shows in the state budget as a reduction in designated general fund, but really isn't actually eliminating that activity. They're just transitioning it to a different structure that won't appear in the state budget.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, the transition you've just described was wholly at the discretion of the university. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, this came from the recommendations from the Board of Regents. So getting into non-agency items, what we often call statewide items in the budget world, debt service is the payment of debt obligations primarily from prior general obligation bond issuances, but also the school bond debt program. We've put forward funding for the school bond debt program at 50% of statutory calculation in fiscal year 22. This is the same as was appropriated in fiscal year 20. In fiscal year 21, the entire amount was vetoed. So this is an increase from the prior year, but flat from 2 years ago in terms of the percent funding. That increase is offset by other, partially offset by other reductions in debt service costs to the state. Some of the prior debt obligations are winding down. So you can see the change from 21 to 22 is only a $4 million increase, while we've added in $12.5 million for school bond debt reimbursement. And I,
Representative Josephson,
through the chair, I guess what I'm confused by is, I is you've combined previous bond debt of a general nature with school bond debt, which I view as sort of an annual affair. And so I'm just struggling with that a little bit.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, really the purpose here is the slide is reflecting, kind of mirroring the structure in the budget document itself, where debt service is, or in our kind of budget reporting, where we include kind of all debt obligations of the state, whether it's geo bond debt or debt on behalf of another entity where we pay, you know, debt that has been issued by, say, the university, where we pick up some debt service costs for them based on prior agreements, as well as school bond debt. So it's just looking at debt, whether it was issued by the state or issued by another party, where we have an agreement to help assist with those debt payments. So you're right in that there are different and fairly distinct flavors of debt that are in the state budget. You know, geo bond debt is a, you know, constitutional form of debt, whereas school bond debt is a statutory program. But they're all in our state budget reports. We kind of commingle all different types of debt together.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out just sort of intellectually is, for example, if the Anchorage School District takes on the people of Anchorage take on $50 million of debt, and we pay in an affluent year, 2013, we pay 70% on behalf of them. And then maybe this year we pay 35%. Can in a future year they come back to try to get the other 35, or is it gone for all time? Do you see what I'm saying?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think I understand if you're asking if in a future year we could compensate a community for, you know, differences between, you know, what that statutory obligation is and what we did pay in that year. You know, there'd be nothing to, you know, restrict some kind of community assistance distribution of that nature. The debt service payment itself, though, you know, is due from that community to, you know, the debtor, and so, you know, that debt service payment will have been made by the community, presumably, because it is their obligation. So it wouldn't necessarily be going back and paying the debt, but there could be some other community assistance type of arrangement.
Representative Ortiz, and then LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Steiniger, the governor, of course, has put forward a potential bond package to fund the capital budget. If that proposal were to go through with generally the numbers that he's putting forward as a part of that proposal, can you project when we would see an impact to the debt service would be FY23, and can you project how much of an impact that would see if that proposal would go through as planned?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, if once all of the debt has been, all of those bonds have been issued, the projected debt service cost is $22.8 million. You know, there'd be some staggering to it getting issued. So the debt service cost in the first year may not be the full 22.8, but it would, you know, escalate to that point over time as, you know, as the debt's issued. So I don't know exactly how much would be in 23, but some lesser amount. I think the state debt manager has an estimate of what the first year debt service costs would be, and I just don't know that off the top of my head based on his projections of issuance timing.
Okay. And just about, and then for how long ideally would that last into the system? In other words, how long would that $22 million figure go forward into the future?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's a 20-year debt.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative LeBron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we're on debt service, the prior slide, we were talking about the University of Alaska, and they have some debt that they pay out of their allocation of state funding. What's the annual debt service that the university carries, and what's the total amount of debt that they are responsible for?
Through the chair, Representative Laban, I think I'll have to get that from the university and get that number to you. I don't know that off the top of my head.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's about $25 million, and normally they ask for assistance for debt service in a capital budget. And now the total amount, I'm not aware of, but their annual debt service obligation, I believe, is around $25 million. Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
So slide 29 is the charts are covering state assistance to retirement. As you can see, there's a rather large spike back in 2015. In that year, the state made a large deposit into the retirement systems. We've been seeing a rising trend in the actuarial cost of retirement, and to offset that, made a one-time payment into the system, which significantly reduced the state assistance payments in the following years. However, you can see that those state assistance payments have risen up a little bit since that time. However, in fiscal year 22, the actuarial projection is actually coming down a little bit from fiscal year 21. So it's coming down to about $342 million. We do have separate legislation to change the way that we're financing these retirement system payments, or the state assistance portion of those retirement system payments, that would just allow us to access other fund sources to pay for a portion of this cost that currently is all borne by unrestricted general fund. A couple other high points in statewide items in the FY22 operating budget. We have the community assistance program that's funded based on the statutory calculation of power cost equalization earnings, which made available about $12.4 million for the program. That'll equate to a slightly less than $20 million payout to communities. And the oil and gas tax credits, we funded at the statutory minimum of $60 million, and we propose to utilize ADA receipts to pay that.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Mr. Steiner, can you tell us again how the $12.3 million becomes $20 million in terms of community assistance?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the community assistance program is paid for out of a capitalized fund. One-third of that fund's balance goes out in community payments at the start of each fiscal year. The amount in the fund for the start of fiscal year 22 will be about $60 million, of which $20 million will spin off, and then the deposit of $12.4 million will go in. I actually might have that number wrong slightly for fiscal year 21, because I believe it's actually in fiscal year 22. Sorry, the start of fiscal year 23, I believe, is when about $20 million will spin off after the payments in 20, at the beginning of 22. I can provide you a written table that shows the deposits in and the appropriations out, since I'm having trouble exactly getting the numbers for you right here.
No,
yeah.
Sorry. This money is down, however, because the governor vetoed our effort to recapitalize. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the last fiscal year, or the last year's budget, there were proposed two deposits made into the fund. The governor vetoed one of those two deposits. The rationale behind that was that we knew there was significant amount of money coming in from the CARES Act that would get distributed out to communities. The community assistance fund and the allowability of costs from community assistance fund are much broader than CARES Act, so we know it's not an apples to apples ability to spend. However, we knew that that CARES Act money coming in would offset a lot of costs in the communities, and while not, perfect one-to-one, should make them whole for the reduction in that community assistance payment in fiscal year 20 and 21.
It just creates a planning problem for FY 23 and 24. I mean, as I understand it, if we assume, and I think you're largely right, that local governments are being satisfied in other ways, it creates a planning problem for next fiscal year and the year after, because the cliff will come and this won't be adequately capitalized. And when I arrived in 2013, the previous year, the community assistance was $90 million, which was $30 million more than typical, and now we're, you know, so it's another example of burdening local government. Concerned about. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz. Representative LeBon.
Yes, the first bullet under significant budget changes reads, legislation proposed to leverage non-general fund sources for State of Alaska as an employer. So are you building into your budget amount any changes in the funding away from general fund sources for retirement assistance, or is that still to be determined?
Through the chair, Representative LeBon, these numbers reflect the calculation prior to that legislation. So the impact of that legislation will come through a fiscal note. It's not reflected in these budget numbers.
Thank you.
Mr. Steininger?
And so that is the close of these slides. We also have, you know, if there's time, we have budget amendments that have been released, you know, prior or subsequent to the governor's budget in December. If the committee would like me to go through those, there's a spreadsheet in your packets or, yeah.
And we've got about 5 minutes, which obviously we couldn't get through everything. I think you've also got the 10-year plan that we're maybe wanting to look at. But maybe we can go a few minutes over, but I don't want to short legislative finance either on their time. So maybe we'll let you get through the rest of your presentation and we'll hold the questions till the very end. And did you have also the 10-year plan that you're going to touch on as well?
Chair Foster, there were some slides that we covered in the very first day that covered the first 5 years of the 10-year plan. Really, that was the focus there.
Okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and get through the governor's amendments, and like I say, we'll just hold our questions till the end, and then we'll try to jump over to Ledge Finance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should have a 6-page spreadsheet available to you, and I'll just run through high points on each page, and if there's questions, please chime in. So on page one, you have a small adjustment to the Office of Information Technology to add a position that will serve the new Department of Family and Community Services. You also have a technical adjustment in Department of Corrections. Just when the bill was printed in December, the order of some of the budgetary allocations was misordered, and this is to correct that. There's a $10,000 increase in federal receipts in Department of Corrections to allow them to receive a federal grant. There's also a small adjustment in the Department of Education. The department determined that they didn't require this much general fund match for a federal program, and so rather than spending it elsewhere, are removing it from their budget. You have a technical adjustment on line 5 to align the Alaska post-secondary education budget with a separate proposal made in December. That just, it needed to be made in two places and it had been omitted in one. In the Department of Environmental Conservation, this is a technical adjustment to a change record that was simply labeled incorrectly when it was first transmitted. Also in Department of Environmental Conservation on line 7 is an increase in spill prevention and response. Earlier on the DEC slide, I talked about a reduction to bring that fund in line with its over-appropriation and its kind of declining balance. The department had overshot that estimate and needs to add back some funding. This still brings them in line with that, bringing them to a sustainable spend from that fund based on current revenue collections. In fish and game, there's a $50,000 item for Exxon Valdez oil spill to adjust their funding level for projects done by the Commercial Fisheries Division. Moving to the next page, item 9, there was a technical drafting error in the budget where there's some erroneous language in the numbers section of the bill. In line 10, you have $900,000 in federal receipts, and line 11 is $2.1 million. This is moving a portion of the Dingell Johnson and Pittman Robertson programs into the operating budget. We discussed this on the fish and game slide in just the way that they're managing what previously was in the capital budget. Line 12, in the Office of Management and Budget, you have the addition of an admin services director for the new Department of Family and Community Services. Line 13, the department or the Division of Elections requires some funding that's related to translating ballots in different languages. This previously was funded by the federal government. Federal appropriations now are focusing more on election security and not ballot accessibility and language accessibility. So in order to continue that activity, we need general fund support. On line 14, there is a slight change to that elimination of the two building plan review positions. The department had overestimated the amount of money that could be removed alongside those positions, and so an adjustment of $16,000 is needed. Line 15 is a replacement of a sortie associated with a prior plan to have local police departments pay in for the training academy that they were not able to receive those funds from those local police departments. Line 16, also in public safety, is a new federal grant for the safe inventory, or the safe ITR, which is sexual assault forensic evidence inventory tracking. Line 17 is in the Department of Revenue. This is a department-wide risk management activity. This is associated both with physical security risk as well as digital security risk. Line 18 is another technical correction to a drafting error from the bill. Line 19 is a sortie associated with highways and aviation, again related to those revenue shortfalls from motor fuel tax as well as aviation fuel taxes. You have also line 20 is an addition of maintenance stations. There's a couple of those. Line 20, 21, or 21 is rural airport paint striping, but there's another maintenance station down on line 25. So there's a couple of maintenance stations that have been supported with CERSA Act funding, and you'll see those amendments here. That funding is available for a couple of years, but after a couple of years, it will expire and need to be addressed otherwise. Line 22 is a technical adjustment to address a description. And this actually answers a question from earlier in the committee meeting about which roads are part of that $25,000. And you can see the list of roads there in that line. Line 23, again, is related to the fuel tax shortfalls. Line 24, the department had, under COVID, changed the way that they do shifts on the Dalton Highway in order to reduce the amount of travel needed. They have seen that this has been pretty successful in terms of the actual service levels they're able to provide and kind of staff morale issues. So they're looking to continue that through utilization of CERSA Act funding. Line 25, again, is another maintenance station, and 26 is airport paint stripping, which is, you know, just you'll see several of these for the different regions of the state, as well as on the next page. Line 27 is another item related to the tax shortfalls. Lines 29 and 30 are technical adjustments when the cost of living adjustment for airport safety employees was implemented in the budget. It was done at 3%, which was the cost of living adjustment for a different bargaining unit. So that's been updated to the 7% that was negotiated with those bargaining units. On line 31 is a request from the judicial branch to implement recommendations from the state legislature's task force. That's $480,000. From line 34 on, we have items from the language section of the bill. Line 34 is an update to a description related to the ability to collect federal receipts for construction of a natural gas pipeline. Line 35 is language that will extend the community grants through the CARES Act as a result of the CERS Act extending that deadline for expenditure. We need language allowing for that appropriation to extend through the available time period. Line 36 is an adjustment to the dividend from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. Their dividend amount wasn't known at the time of publication of the budget in December. Line 37 is $950,000 associated with redistricting for the Division of Elections. So the division doesn't do the redistricting work, but once redistricting has been completed, they will have to print new voter ID cards and produce materials reflecting those new boundaries. Line 38 is to allow the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to carry funds granted through the RPL process related to housing assistance from the CERSA Act and to allow them to carry those into fiscal years 22 and 23, which is the allowable time period for that grant. Line 39 is, line 39 is erroneous and is associated with line 38, simply is, shouldn't have been printed on the spreadsheet, but is associated with extending that $168.5 million. Line 40 is language that would allow when the WAMI program, which provides scholarships to medical students, when those students don't come back to the state to serve as doctors, they have to repay those scholarships. Currently, that repayment goes into the general fund, but the scholarships paid out of the Higher Education Investment Fund, and so this would allow for that repayment to go back into the fund it was paid out of. Line 41 and 42 are requests from the legislature related to redistricting. Lines 45 and on are technical in nature from a budget perspective, but do actually reflect some things that are policy considerations to be understood. The Department of Administration is consolidating both HR activities and procurement activities. Procurement activities and the PCNs associated, for the most part, were reflected into the December budget. The HR PCNs hadn't been, fully identified and understood at that time period. So these changes are reflecting those transfer of HR staff into Department Administration as a central service. On the next page, line 47 is completing the transfer of the procurement consolidation for positions that hadn't been identified in December. Line 48 and 49 are just various transactions within, line 48 is a transaction within a department to adjust for that shift in where those PCNs are budgeted so that they can pay that bill. Line 49 is aligning maintenance activities that Department of Transportation has been accommodating within their budget, but on behalf of other tenants. For example, the Department of Administration is in a building that the Department of Transportation has just been paying the rent and paying for the utilities costs, and you can see a list of other agencies that have been in the same sort of arrangement while the cost was getting paid and the rent was getting paid, the utilities were being paid, there wasn't a connection between the tenant and the actual cost. So we've transferred those dollars out of the budget to the tenant for them to then pay that lease through Department of Transportation. While it does create kind of that complexity, it does put that cost center where the demand is coming from.
Thank you. We're running into Ledge Finance's time here, and I know that there's a lot of information. These amendments are going to be taken up in subcommittee, and so either we can push those off till then, or we can come back tonight this evening if folks wanted to continue on here. We can, I guess, take that up here later, that question. But if we could just maybe move into Ledge Finance for now, and then we'll figure out if we want to continue on tonight. So thank you very much, Mr. Steiniger. Mr. Painter.
Brief at ease.
Finance back on record at 10:11 a.m. And before us, we have Mr. Alexi Painter with Ledge Finance. And if you could maybe put yourself on record and go and get started.
For the record, Alexi Painter, and I'm the Legislative Fiscal Analyst. So in this presentation, I will be going through the history of Alaska's structural budget deficit. We'll talk about Ledge Finance's budget baselines for fiscal year 22, how the governor's proposal lines up to those baselines, as well as what the big picture is in his budget. And then we'll talk about the governor's 10-year plan and the fiscal outlook. Starting on the structural budget deficit, the current year that we're in, fiscal year 21, is the ninth straight year of fiscal deficits. The governor's FY22 proposal will bring us to a full decade. Through that period, we've reduced the budget from $7.8 million in FY13, that was our peak budget year, to $4.5 billion in FY21, which is a 43% decrease to our unrestricted general fund budget. However, during that time, our budget reserve balances have dropped from over $16 billion in FY13 to under $1 billion today. And one note about that is it looks like we've spent $15 billion of savings, but if you look at those funds have sort of regenerated some of that during the period. We've actually drawn down our reserves by about $20 billion during that period. The general fund is projected to owe the CBR nearly $13 billion at the end of FY21 because all of the withdrawals from that account are constitutional debt from the general fund back to the CBR. Next few slides are some graphical illustrations of this picture. The first one, starting with the petroleum revenue and non-petroleum revenue picture over the last decade, So you can see here, FY12, the last year we had a balanced budget. Petroleum revenue was nearly $9 billion. It dropped year over year to under $1 billion of petroleum revenue in FY17. And then it rose a little bit in FY18 and 19, and then is back at that comparable level in FY21 and 22 in the forecast. Prices have been somewhat higher since the forecast, so maybe we may get a couple hundred million more. That would still represent a much lower level than we've seen over the past few years or past decade. And this is the top cause of our budget problems, is obviously this dramatic decline in revenue. The next slide shows the budget over that period. And you can see, again, the budget moving downwards like the revenue did from our peak year in FY13. What's interesting here is that not all of these items move together. So our peak total budget year is FY13, but the peak for the operating budget alone is FY14. That year, facing a deficit, the legislature reduced the capital budget substantially. In FY15, statewide items were reduced as well. That's our peak year for agency operations alone. And then going down beyond that, we get to these lower levels with the budget cuts in FY16, 17, and 18. And then putting those two together, you can see our fiscal picture over the last decade with the revenue in the background there, and then the bars showing the budget. So you can see that surplus in FY12 and then followed by deficits. The percent of market value draw in FY19 began, which you can see significantly reduced the deficit. However, we've still had a deficit every year despite that draw. That POMV draw is now our largest source of revenue, but it was not alone enough to balance the budget. We're now looking at 10 straight years of fiscal deficits. And this has eaten away at our reserves. You can, again, see this trend from FY13 at the peak of over $16 billion. In FY20, we finally spent the last bit of the statutory budget reserve. That fund now has no balance. Constitutional budget reserve has gone from over $12 billion in FY14 to under $1 billion today. So, as we've made these reductions over the past decade, they have not fallen on agencies equally, just as they have not fallen equally on all areas of the budget, from statewide items and so forth. Since FY15, our peak year of agency operations, to our current year, the agency operations are down over $500 million, but not every agency is down. Our public protection agencies, which includes the Departments of Corrections, Public Safety, the court system, and the Department of Law, are actually up 6% during this period. The Department of Education and Early Development is relatively flat. It's down about 2%. That's primarily because there was outside the formula funding in FY15 that is no longer in the budget this year. But that's a relatively flat amount. That's the amount going out to school districts primarily.
Yeah, let's hold questions till the end. We'll let Mr. Painter get through, and then we'll...
Okay. Then the Department of Health and Social Services is down 6%, but actually that's kind of understating the reduction that department has had, because in FY21, there's some one-time money for COVID-19 spending. There are about $95 million of that one-time funding in the FY21 management plan. If you removed that, then the reduction in Health and Social Services would be more like 11%. Then all of the other agencies, so all of the agencies, the smaller agencies from administration, commerce, community, and economic development to our own budget in the legislature, are down significantly more, collectively $441 million, 35.6%. So significant reductions to all of those agencies, while these larger agencies have seen smaller reductions, and in the public protection case, actually seen increases. And I can deal with questions as we go, if you'd like, at the end of slides.
Yesterday, we ended up finishing our first presentation at the end of 2 hours.
Sure.
I want to make sure that we can at least get the information out first. And then if we come up short on questions, folks can always come to you later, or we can always set up a meeting later or whatnot. But if we can at least just get the information out for now. And subcommittees are also going to be taking up a lot of things when we're dealing with a prior presentation, for example. So with that, Mr. Painter.
All right, and one more slide on kind of the history here. And this just shows agency operations over the same period, kind of similar to the last slide, although this one we break out the University of Alaska and transportation. And I think the trend here is really interesting to see, where from our peak in FY15, there's steady reductions down to FY18. And the budget this year, the governor's amended budget, is almost the exact same amount as the FY18 budget. So we did make steady reductions down to FY18. The budget rose a little bit in the next couple of years. A lot of that is due to these COVID expenses. There were some increases in FY19 that then the governor's vetoes in FY20 wiped out, but then the supplemental for COVID and fire suppression and so forth in FY20 kind of brought that back up. But then going back into FY22, essentially we're flat with where we were 4 years ago. We've not really been able to make large reductions since then. There are some agencies that have seen significant reductions over that period, most notably the University of Alaska, but those reductions have really offset increases elsewhere, and particularly those are in the public protection agencies, which after House Bill 49, that the criminal justice reform, all of those saw significant increases. So these cuts we've taken during this administration and over the past few years have really just gotten us back to that same total level as we were 4 years ago. Moving on to the picture this year. So one of the things we hear a lot is that it's confusing to compare the budget from the previous year to the current year because there's a lot of distortions that happen in each given year's budget. In FY21, the biggest example would be all of the COVID relief and expenses associated with that. It causes FY21 to not be a very clean point of comparison for the current year. It looks like if you just compare year to year, there's large reductions, but really those are just the expiration of these temporary one-time items. And so to try to provide a clearer comparison, we've created two baselines for your information. One is current policy, and the other is current law. And again, these are really intended to provide that clean starting point so that when we look at the governor's budget, we have something that is not distorted by previous years as a point of comparison. So for agency operations, we're essentially using what we call the adjusted base that I think all of you are familiar with from subcommittee. That's essentially what the current year's budget with all of the automatic changes like expiration of one-time items and contractual changes. The one difference between our budget baselines and adjusted base is in the Department of Education. We were considering in this in the baselines that the any changes just due to projections and student counts, we roll that into our baselines because those aren't really a policy change, it's just a projection change. The difference between these two scenarios comes in the statewide items and the permit fund dividend. The current policy scenario assumes that we would continue like we did this year, which was a roughly $1,000 PFD, no unrestricted general funds going to school debt reimbursement, the REAA fund, community assistance, or oil and gas tax credits. None of those items received unrestricted general funds this year. Current law assumes that instead on these items, we follow the statutes on the books. So it assumes a statutory permanent fund dividend, full funding of school debt, the REAA fund, community assistance, and oil and gas tax credits. So the difference is for the statutory PFD, about $2 billion versus the $680 million we appropriated in the current year. And then for statewide items, which I'll provide detail on in the next slide, the difference is about $168.5 million between these two baselines. In debt service, the difference between the baselines here is the municipal project reimbursement debt. The governor vetoed $2.4 million from the current budget for that amount. So that's the difference between our current policy and current law. Breaking out school debt reimbursement, you can see, again, the governor vetoed all funding for that this year. In current law, we assume that's fully funded. State retirement, there's no difference because those were fully funded in the current budget. The REAA fund, regional educational attendance area, that was all funding for that was vetoed in FY21, so there's a difference there. For community assistance, in FY21, the governor vetoed UGF going for that, but funds from the Power Cost Equalization Fund did go in. And so in our baseline, we assume current policy is no UGF. Current law is the unrestricted general funds needed to get to the statutory $30 million deposit. And on community assistance, I would give a quick plug for a white paper that we have on our website that explains the program, the projected how the mechanics work, as well as the projected amounts going forward. We actually have two versions of that white paper now. The short version is basically just the funding only. There's also an extended version that includes a lot of background on the program from legislative research that provides kind of a historical overview of that program as well as the current funding information. So if you have questions about how that program works, that's a great resource to help you understand it. And then oil and gas tax credits, again, $0 in the current budget, and the $60 million is the statutory deposit in FY22. So if you put all of these together, we're using a $150 million capital budget assumption for both. If you put all these together, essentially the current policy budget would be about a $900 million deficit. That's roughly similar to what we're facing in the current year in FY21. That makes sense intuitively that they'd be pretty similar. So that's about a $900 million deficit. In the current law scenario, the deficit would be projected to be about $2.4 billion. So, you know, again, there's this difference in the statewide items and then in the dividend that lead to a significantly larger deficit in that baseline. Bringing in the governor's budget, so the governor's budget in agency operations is about $69 million below our baselines. And we'll get into where those differences are. But note that that's not nearly the reduction you see if you just compare agency ops last in the current year to this year, because a lot of those were one-time items for COVID relief. So really, there's only $69.3 million of reductions in the governor's budget, not these larger numbers that you see in the straight line comparison. In statewide items, the governor is above current policy, and that's because of the 50% funding for the school debt and REAA fund. However, still significantly below the current law assumption, $138.9 million below, because again, 50% funding, not 100%, as well as some things we'll talk about later in other items. The capital budget, the governor's number is below our baseline. That's because of the use of the AHFC bonding. That adds about $104 million to his capital budget that shows up as other because it's bond proceeds. If you counted that as UGF, which would be kind of the typical fund source, the governor's capital budget is over $160 million. That's a bit above our baseline, but a lot of that is because we had in FY21 a partially funded capital budget. We didn't appropriate the entire thing in the year, and so a lot of that's showing up as either supplementals or in some cases in increased projects this year. And again, the PFD, the governor has the statutory dividend, so it's higher than the current policy baseline, but matching the current law. And so the governor ends up with about a $2.1 billion deficit. So it's, you know, larger than that current policy deficit, but a little bit smaller than current law because of the reductions made by the governor in agency operations and the capital budget. So getting into the agency operations differences, the governor is $69.3 million below our baseline. The largest reduction is to Medicaid. That budget is down $35.1 million. However, funding available to that program is really flat in the governor's budget. He's proposing language that would take $35 million of potentially lapsing funds this year and rolling them forward into next year. What that does is essentially take money that's counted in this year's budget, push it forward to next year's budget. That makes it look like there's a reduction to the program, but the same amount of funding would be available to that program. With the CARES Act, one of the provisions, actually is in a previous Coronavirus Relief Act, but one of the provisions in that was a higher federal medical assistance percentage rate, FMAP. Our normal rate for the non-expansion population is 50%. It's temporarily increased to 56.2%. That creates a significant savings in our budget. It's about $15 to $17 million per quarter. That's been extended throughout this fiscal year and potentially to the end of this calendar year. And so this year, we're in line to lapse money from Medicaid because primarily of this FMAP increase. And next year, if that's extended, we may be able to take reduce funding without impacting services. However, if we reduce the budget, then the following year, just to avoid a service reduction, we would have to increase the budget. I think the administration sees that as a feature, that it would provide a lower baseline to provide the basis for future cuts. But it does mean that when you're looking at the governor's budget, this looks like a large reduction, but is not a service reduction at this point. And it means that if we're trying to find future reductions, you're essentially building in future Medicaid cuts already into your budget. And that means that just to stay even with the current budget, we would have to find additional Medicaid cuts next year. The one large service reduction we see in the governor's budget is the University of Alaska. As Mr. Steininger said, it's the last year in the compact, so a $20 million decrease. The Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is also down. As you just heard, that's primarily due to one-time fund changes to utilize CARES Act money and then the reduction to the Marine Highway System. The other main service reduction we see, and really it shouldn't impact service too much, is Public Assistance Administration, reducing that by 100 positions. The idea is that will be through efficiencies. And I'm highlighting this because I think this is a really good illustration of how difficult it is to reduce the level of spending overall. Because this is, a reduction of 100 positions, that's a quarter of the positions in this program. However, it adds up to about $3 million, which, when you have a $2 billion deficit, doesn't make a huge dent. And all of these sort of minor cuts essentially are needed to balance out some of the natural increases or the increases elsewhere. So you can find cuts like this every year that seem major. 100 positions is a whole lot to cut, and they don't really move the needle a whole lot in the size of the budget. The K-12 formula is fully funded in the governor's budget, but the student count changes that are projected result in a reduction of funding. We actually, as I said, we include that in our baseline, so that's not included in the $69.3 million. And the governor did introduce a bill that would amend the formula that would increase funding by $35 million. That's not included in the governor's fiscal summary, and we're not including it in our summary, but I just highlight that to kind of point out that the reductions here do not include that potential increase. All of the other changes across the agencies net to about a $6 million increase. A lot of that increase is with the split of health and social services that added some UGF, as well as a couple of other departments, public safety and corrections, I believe. So statewide items, the governor has $464 million. As we've talked about, school debt and REAA fund are funded at 50% of the statutory level in the governor's budget. Community assistance, they're putting in $12.4 million of PCE funds in line with that statute, but no unrestricted general funds. And what that leads to is a $19.5 million payout in FY23. For comparison, in community assistance, the base payments to municipalities in the current year are $19.7 million. So this $19.5 million distribution is just shy of the amount to pay the bases and would lead to those being prorated and no per capita funding, meaning that all cities would receive the same amount of funding, all boroughs would receive the same funding, because there would be no room for per capita funding based on this request. The governor is proposing $60 million for oil and gas tax credits. However, he's proposing to use ADA receipts, which are an other fund code. That's not a designated use of those funds. There's no real link between those programs. The traditional funding source for this item would be UGF, so this is kind of an artificial budget lowering tactic. And as Mr. Steininger mentioned, they also have a PERS bill that is not included in the governor's budget. It's just a separate bill that would reduce the budget by $31 million total. Moving on to the capital budget, it totals $62.2 million of UGF, but as I mentioned, it's bolstered by an AHFC bond package. The repayment of those bonds would actually not hit us on the budget side, they'd hit us on the revenue side, because they'd be paid out of AHFC's revenue. AHFC sends an annual dividend to the state, and that dividend would be reduced by the amount of these debt service payments. So we wouldn't see that on the budget side, but there would still be an increase to our future deficits. The governor's GO bond proposal, as Mr. Steininger mentioned, would have a debt service cost that would be, you know, $22 to $23 million. However, not all of that would necessarily come out the first year as the bonds are issued over time. The governor also has a fast-track supplemental that funds some of the unfunded FY21 projects. Some of them were moved to the FY21-22 budget, and others were funded with the August 2020 RPL package. In our overview of the governor's budget, the big red book and the capital budget section, there's kind of a detailed breakdown of what happened to those unfunded projects. And you can see that between these various funding vehicles, the supplemental, the RPLs, and then increased amounts in the FY22 budget, most of these projects are getting funded in some way in the governor's proposal, but not all just in this straight line, you know, where you can track the spending from one budget to the next, because we've had so many different ways that they're being funded. So putting it all together into a fiscal summary, I'll just focus on a couple of numbers here. So if we look at just agency operations, here we see a $190 million reduction rather than the $69.3 million reduction. Again, that's why we have this baseline. Our baselines get rid of these one-time items. So if you look at this, you'd think there's much larger cuts than there really were. A lot of that is really these expiration of one-time items. So, you know, just the total budget is down $230.6 million before the dividend. However, again, a lot of that's the one-time effect. When you add the dividend back in, before supplementals, there's an increase. However, one of the supplementals the governor is proposing is an increased PFD in FY21. When you add that in, we're back to a lower budget in FY22 than 21. But in the end, the deficit for both years is about $2.1 billion. The governor is meeting that deficit through two different fund sources. In FY21, he's proposing that supplemental dividend come directly out of the ERA for $1.2 billion, as well as the previously approved amounts coming out of the CBR. In FY22, he's proposing the entire dividend come out of the ERA, and then the remaining deficit, which we project to be $93 million, would come out of the CBR. So, you know, in the big picture, the governor's budget builds in several UGF reductions that may be difficult to repeat. So, you know, I've touched on all of them already. Using lapsing balances for Medicaid, using one-time money, federal money in fund changes in DOT, using ADA receipts for tax credits, and using AHFC bonds in the capital budget. And actually, forgot to update this with GovAmends, up to $104 million of those. So these things all kind of artificially lower the size of the budget. It's not to cast judgment on it. We have a fiscal crisis, and the governor is trying to minimize the use of the general fund. That's probably a good thing, but it does make it look like there's big reductions when really it's just changing the way we pay for things. If you took these out, the governor's budget would actually be relatively flat with FY22, about $4.5 billion each year. So the governor's 10-year plan going forward, he's proposing overdraws of the ERA in FY21 and 22, but theoretically balances the budget starting in FY23. The primary way he's balancing it is $900 million to $1.2 billion in new revenue starting in FY23. without specifying the source of that. The governor also is proposing changing the statutory dividend formula from 50% of statutory net income to 50% of the percent of market value draw. That would be a reduction of about $400 million a year compared to the statutory dividend. That dividend payment would still be significantly higher than what we did pay out in FY21, but would be lower than the statute. And then the governor is also building in agency operations reductions of about $100 million a year and for each of FY23 and 24, and then sub-inflation growth beyond that. So essentially, this would take us from the $3.8 billion of agency operations we have in the governor's current budget to $3.7 and $3.6 billion. When, given that some of these things are one-time in nature, that does require finding future reductions to meet those in the governor's plan. So the overdraws from the ERA do come at a cost to future deficits. Because the POMV draws are largest source of revenue, that causes that extra draw reduces the future POMV draws and causes our future deficits to increase by about $160 million in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms. So the legislature and you in this committee have to weigh the economic benefits of a potential stimulus package against the long-term cost. So the governor's proposal is essentially a stimulus package of the supplemental PFD and then a larger PFD in the fall and this general obligation bond proposal. You could think of other potential stimulus packages, if that's your goal, or relief packages that could possibly be more narrowly targeted that would have reduced funding. But the governor's plan is for the PFD and GO bond. The policy choices that you make will have different effects on the economy and different distributional impacts. You know, the past several years, we have not added new revenue, but we have reduced the dividend below the statutory level. And comparing the different options there, you can get to this roughly the same numbers going from either dividend reductions or new revenue, but it has a different impact on different areas of the state and people at different income brackets. So that's something to keep in mind as you're making your choices. If you did want to do the governor's proposal and add new revenue in FY23, that would need to be authorized this year because it takes some time to fully ramp up. Even then, it would be hard to set up a new tax that would start on July 1st next year. Most likely, we'd get only a half year in the first year. So, you know, hitting that target would be very difficult. And if you in the legislature agree to the overdraws of the ERA in the, this year and next year without deficit-filling measures and we leave a structural deficit, that could quickly result in depleting the ERA like the CBR and SBR were because of this point at the top that every time we overdraw from the ERA, it increases our future deficits. So essentially, every year we delay at this point because we don't have the savings buffer in the CBR and SBR anymore, increases our future deficits and mean that we have to reduce services even more in the future or increase taxes even more to make up for those. So these overdraws are very costly in the long term. This last slide shows the impact of just the FY21 and 22 overdraws that the governor proposes on both the ERA balance and then the POMV draw. So you can see that difference in the ERA draw immediately, the ERA balance immediately, going from $14 billion in the, if we follow POMV, to about $11 billion or $10.5 billion if we do the overdraws. And over time, the one thing to note here is that we're assuming no inflation proofing for FY21 through 24. That's in line with legislative intent that went along with the $4 billion transfer. So you see the ERA in both scenarios grows, but then in both it actually declines in the future because the projected earnings are below what's needed to keep pace with inflation. It happens significantly faster with those 2 years of overdraws. The lines show the POMV draws, and you can see that, you know, there's no change really immediately, but as this it works its way through the five-year average, by FY30, you know, there's a significant difference, nearly $200 million larger, you know, $160 million in real terms of a larger deficit in the future. And so with that, I'll answer any questions you have.
Great. Thank you very much. Really, your presentation distills all the important things that we're dealing with into kind of a nice, concise little presentation, and I really appreciate it. It's pretty powerful. So with that, we've got a couple of questions. I want to recognize we're joined at the beginning of your presentation by Representative Edgman, who I know had a meeting dealing with our COVID protocols. So thanks for joining us. We've got a couple of questions. I see we've got Representative Wool and then Josephson and LeBon. So with that, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had questions on page 8 forward, but you know, then when you end with this sobering news, it's not new to any of us, but every time I hear it, it begs the question. For example, the governor proposes $1.2 billion in new revenue, but doesn't specify. And I know you don't work for the governor, so I'm not picking on you or Mr. Steininger for that matter, but I'm just, there's such a scarcity of information or suggestions. There's all kinds of offerings of constitutional amendments, and there's a new PFD formula, all that's great. But there's no $1.2 billion without any recommendations. And as you just said, if we want it by 2023, we got to do it now. So I'm just waiting to hear some real concrete answers to some very, very basic questions as to how we're going to resolve this. We heard from Angela Riddell overdrawing the permanent fund. POMV draw is not suggested. Our forecast of oil production is not great. Our forecast of earnings on the permanent fund for the next 10 years was not that great. So, you know, I'm just waiting to hear from whoever's listening that I'd like to hear some real suggestions. And I have a few myself, but I'm not here on the testifier table. Let me just go to page 14. A few questions. I'll start with that one. Education formula funding, due to lack of enrollment. Where is that? Is that on there somewhere? Yes. There's federal funding coming in, I think $135 million. I'm assuming that can help. I mean, every district's got lack of funding due to enrollment. The state has lack of funding due to enrollment. The federal government stepped up. Is that, can that solve that issue?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, I think it's really a different situation district by district. And I think it's difficult to have a overall answer to that. The districts that are running their own correspondence programs, some of them actually have increased funding in the current year because of the way the hold harmless provision applies only to brick and mortar students. So you can have students switching from brick and mortar to correspondence and then getting counted for a hold harmless and then funded again. And so about half of districts actually have more funding in the current year than they would have or than they had the previous year. The other half of districts, which primarily are ones without correspondence programs, a lot of them are down significantly. There's one district, for example, that is the hold harmless kicks in at 5%. They saw a 4.9% decrease in their student count and therefore didn't trigger the hold harmless. And so there are some of these districts that are down significantly. They do have access to this federal funding that they can use for some purposes, but it's not quite as flexible as general funds. So districts have kind of reported different situations where some have very tight budgets and some are doing a little better because of just the interaction of the formula and the hold harmless and things like that. So I'm not sure that we can give one answer of whether districts are fine or not. I think that answer will vary across the state.
Okay, thank you. One other question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bull.
Thank you. Page 9, you pointed out that 2022 and 2019 are about the same. So we're sort of flat funding, but doesn't the COVID money artificially decrease the 2022 budget so that we're actually, I mean, does that 2022 bar graph there, does that include the federal COVID money or is that in 2021 and that's why there's a decrease in 22 because we no longer have the COVID money?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, that's a great question. So the federal money we don't see directly because this is just UGF, but those some of the there was UGF specific for COVID relief in the FY 20 and 21 budget. That's not in the 22 budget. So you see a reduction because of that. But there are these other reductions, the Medicaid reduction and then DOT are pretty much the two big examples. About $50 million of the decrease here is really due to utilizing federal COVID money instead of general funds. So some of the reason we're down is definitely that. And if you pull those out, then we'd be slightly above FY18 levels. But with those, we're pretty much almost exactly matching FY18.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson and then LeBron.
Through the chair, on page 9, the same page, Mr. Painter, can you remind me how it is that sort of indisputably we've cut the overall budget 44%, but yet FY22 looks like FY18?
Representative Josephson through the chair. So if we extend this back to FY13, you'd see that really in the statewide items and the capital budget, that's where the bulk of the reductions happened. In the agency operations, we're down 11% from FY15. So not nearly this dramatic 43%. But, you know, really these years of reductions were FY16, 17, and 18. And since then, we've just been treading water. So it's actually pretty interesting if you look at this agency by agency, and I can get you a slide that shows that, that every single agency had UGF reductions between FY15 and FY18. So every single agency was down. Since FY18, it's a mix. You know, overall we're slightly down, but there's some that are up, some that are down, and so those reductions have just offset the increases elsewhere. It's just been money moving essentially from one department to the other. Whereas in this period, at 15 to 18, it was across the board.
On the issue of on page 12, when you look at the current policy, you're assuming about a $600 million PFD. So without that, the pre-transfer deficit would be about $200 million and change. Is that right?
Yes.
On page 14, I'm sort of embarrassed that I guess I read something about SB 58, but when the administration came in, very early in the administration's term, it sought briefly about a $250 million cut to K-12. And now it wants to increase it by $35.5 million from its essentially from its base.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct. The bill would increase the correspondence multiplier from 90% to 100%, and also move correspondence students so they receive all the other multipliers, the school costs or district costs and school size and so forth. So they would essentially move into the formula, and that increases the funding in the governor's proposal.
I mean, you're not the right person to ask about the change in policy, so I won't ask you. Just a couple more questions, if I might. Just looking at my notes here. On page 16, and I know, Mr. Painter, and I respect that you don't want to get into policy calls, and we don't pay to do that normally. but yesterday we learned that the state has $122 million to spend on surface transportation projects. I have no clue what the definition of that is, but I bet I could get creative with it and make it broad. Should that change our disposition toward a geo bond? Because it strikes me that if we have $150 million to spend on capital budgets, we add the $122 million, we're at $270 million. that's pretty good. I know that we have the ability to issue more bonds. I heard the co-chairman of the other body express some reluctance on this issue. He believed that the timing wasn't right. Are you comfortable venturing a view on that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so it is a policy question, and I can't really give a definitive answer, but you know, transportation projects are one part of the GO bond. There are other projects where there's significant need. So the school construction and major maintenance lists, for example, have combined about $400 million of projects on those lists. Those lists do not include all the potential projects. As the legislature found out a decade ago when we funded the entire list, the next year repopulated, there's a lot more need than what shows up on those lists. We could fund an entire $350 million GO bond on school construction and major maintenance projects alone. There's needs in deferred maintenance as well. While not all deferred maintenance will qualify as a GO bond because it has to be a capital improvement per the Constitution, there's some projects that fall into that deferred maintenance bucket that do qualify because they do, you know, to fix it, you need to make an improvement, and therefore it qualifies. And the state has a $2 billion backlog of deferred maintenance. So there's no shortage of need, and while the presence of the federal money may make it less urgent to fund transportation projects specifically, there's certainly no shortage of projects that could vie for a $350 million bond package.
Last question.
Representative Josephson.
Unsustainability, essentially, of the governor's proposal to draw from these other sources to pay for government. I guess this really comes down to, for me, do I live in a world where I'm finally going to see revenue raised, or do I not live in that world? If I continue to not live in that world, this is as creative as anything else to get us to balance. Is that fair?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. I mean, yes. If the legislature is not attempting to solve the fiscal problem this year, then doing everything within our power to increase the life of the Constitutional Budget Reserve is probably a sensible policy. If the legislature is seeking to solve the fiscal problem this year, perhaps, you know, we don't need to do all of these things.
Representative Josephson.
Wrong. On the same page, the $35 million of lapsing balances for Medicaid, even though this creates this further cliff wall that I refer to, the fact is for FY22, the governor's proposal would result in essentially flat funding of Medicaid because the Congress is coming through for us again. Is that right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, that's correct. Based on the, even without the lapsing balances, if the FMAP increase is extended to the end of the fiscal year, we would be able to essentially meet a reduction of this magnitude.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Lexi, if we can go to slide 12. I'm going to follow up with a question that I believe started with Representative Josephson, and he focused on agency operations. Can you tell me a little bit about UGF revenue? When this slide was produced, there were some assumptions made about revenue. Have those assumptions changed? And this is looking forward for fiscal year beginning July 1st of this year, correct? So any assumption changes on revenue?
Representative LeBon, through the chair, this is based on the fall DOR forecast. That assumed $48 oil in FY22. Actual prices are about $10 higher, and we get about $28 to $30 million more in revenue for every dollar that prices go higher. So we're looking at this point, probably, you know, $300 million or so more revenue in FY22 if current prices hold. We should get a spring revenue forecast in the next few weeks that will provide an updated number. And my I would guess that it would be about $300 million higher at this point based on current activity.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman. So if we look at the PFD line plus the higher revenue number, we do not have a deficit potentially.
Representative LeBond, through the chair, we would not have a deficit if we paid no dividend.
And follow up here, I'm going to now jump to slide 15, if you could. There's a reference made to using ADA receipts. That's to pay the oil and gas tax credits. Is that $60 million over and above the ADA dividend amount?
Representative LeBond, through the chair, yes. That would be an additional draw from ADA beyond their dividend, which is about $17 million.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, to stay on that topic, do you have an opinion regarding that size of a draw against ADA's capital amount?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, I think that's a policy call. I would say that, you know, they have about a $1.4 billion net position, but that includes, you know, ownership stakes. They have cash that on hand in the latest statements that could support this draw, but it would reduce the amount they have available for future projects. And I think in the eyes of credit raters, you know, regardless of the size of the draw, any draw from ADA for a state obligation, I think, would be viewed negatively, even if they had the cash. But I think in terms of ADA's cash flow, they do have sufficient cash on hand, but this would be a significant portion of that cash.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one final, maybe a more a comment than a question. I think you're spot on correct that overdrawing the ADA capital account impacts future activities of ADA, their ability to bond projects at competitive interest rates. Their rating would stand to be impacted by an overdraw of their capital account. So you look at this, is it a one-year, one-time only draw on ADA receipts, or is this the future program? What's the total level of oil and gas tax credits to be repaid? It's not just $60 million. This is just a one-year event. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative LeBond, through the chair, I know it's just a comment, but I'll just say that the amount outstanding of tax credits is about $700 million. In the governor's 10-year plan, there is no UGF for tax credits in any year, so I'm not sure if their plan is to continue these draws or find another source, but they don't put that in as UGF.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I just want to reiterate, this is a great presentation. It really distills all the issues down here, and it presents, you know, the real challenge that we have before us. So with that, our next meeting is scheduled for later today, March 2nd at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear presentations from the Department of Revenue on the state's credit review, state debt summary, and cash flow reserve funds. So with that, we will be adjourned at 11:01 a.m. Thank you.